So, okay, first of all, just to finish the last week, how many people, we were doing dynamic programming. Let's see, how did we do? Okay, how many people got all four working? Nobody. How many got three out of four working? Nobody. How many people got two out of four working? Nobody. How many people got one of them working? Nobody got any of them working. Okay, that's a little bit depressing. Did people try and get stuck, or are people sort of, what was the issue? You've got what? So you say you... And that one didn't work. Did you get it to the point where it read, or? Okay, so anybody else, the problem with the elephants, did people, other people try and think that they got it, or was this
I had trouble changing the match functions so that it could work for the elephants. I wasn't sure what exactly I should be comparing.
Okay. Any other reactions to that, or not reactions to it, or anything like that? Okay, a little bit depressing, but that's life. Okay, we'll know for next time. Okay. Actually, if one of you wants, suddenly it just occurred to me that I don't know what people's plans are for the summer or anything like that. If somebody is sufficiently frustrated and sufficiently underemployed this summer, that they would like to have a project to simplify or come up with a more user-friendly, set of test cases for the judge. Okay, let me know that. Okay, I mean, this might be a substantial. I mean, I have a vision of a more sort of a substantial project, time-wise, that might be very helpful if, in light of the problems people are having here. And so, if you have nothing to do this summer, and you want something to do, let me know. Okay, but if you want something to do next week and you have nothing to do, okay, then we should work on our, get onto the last couple of chapters. And this has been geometry. So what we're now going to do is go with the problems on geometry this week and computational, what is historically called computational geometry. Next week, and these are, I know everybody had geometry in high school, okay, so everyone knows a little bit about geometry, but let's look at these problems, and hopefully, again, some of them are not so bad, but we will see. So the first problem is you have a situation where you have a gopher and a dog, okay? And the gopher is sitting someplace. There's a dog sitting someplace else. And the gopher has had dug a bunch of gopher holes. And the dog wants to run and eat the gopher, what dogs do. And the gopher wants to escape. It's another thing the gopher wants to do. So we know how fast the dog can run. We know how fast the gopher can run. Okay? The question is, so as soon as the gopher and the dog see each other, the gopher is going to run for a gopher hole to hide. The dog is going to run for the gopher, okay, directly. Okay? And the question here is, can you find a hole where the gopher can escape? Okay, so what do we actually know? We know the gopher is, if I look at it, it's probably the case that the gopher is twice as fast, the dog is twice as fast as the gopher. And basically they're both going to run to the same hole, and the question is there a hole where the gopher can arrive there before the dog? Okay? Any questions? Okay, so that is the first problem. Okay? Any questions? First question is to make sure about it. Is the goal for the gopher to go to the closest hole?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily. Why might not?
The dog might be right there.
Yeah. So it should be clear. It should be clear that the gopher should not run to the closest hole,
but should run to the criteria of what the right hole is a little bit more complicated. Any questions? Okay.
Fair enough. The second problem has to do with a tug-of-war game. Okay, so the story is a little bit silly perhaps, but there's this this country where they like to play tug-of-war, which is where you have two teams standing on ends of a rope and pulling. And the room where they like to play it in has a pillar in the middle of it.
Okay, so... The rope is sometimes not necessarily a direct, the rope does not necessarily go directly between two points. Sometimes if there's a pillar in the way, the rope will stretch, go along the pillar, and that would be the shortest rope that could be possibly between the two points. And the basic problem is given a circular pillar, given two points in the plane, find the shortest rope that you can make that you can use to connect those two points. Okay? Any questions?
The rope will just be a straight line?
Well, the rope can't be a straight line around the circle. So the first thing to know here is that a rope is a rope, okay? And the rope's bent.
Okay.
So, it is not a line like that. It is presumably going to be, in the interesting case, probably a straight line to a circular segment to a straight line. Okay, and the question of what it is, now we start talking about tangents and things like this. Okay? So this now reminds us, we have to remember how do we compute tangents and things like this that we used to do in high school. Any questions? Okay?
So that's another, in principle, elementary sounding problem. The third problem has to do with a family where you're trying to divide a cake among two children. Now I have two children. This is something I'm,
thank you. In the near future, you're going to have to worry about this problem. You've got this cake, they each want equal amounts of cake. If it's a circular cake, what is the easiest way to cut the cake somewhere through the center, right? Now the problem is they don't want that the cake has cherries on it. So not only do you want to have cut the cake physically in half, you also want to make sure that every child, each half has the same number of cherries. Okay, this can only be done physically if you have an odd number of cherries. Okay, an even number of cherries. Okay. And the question is, does there always exist a cup where you can make both the cake even and the cherries even? And if so, find such a cup.
You can only cut it once?
We're allowed to cut it once. Okay?
So let's look at this thing again. You've got, it says here that basically you've got, the cherries are points, okay, A and B, they're point cherries, and the goal is to find a line that not only cuts the cake in half, but cuts the cherries in half. Any questions? Okay. Well, let's think about that. Is there always an answer?
Okay, is it always true that you can cut, if I give you a cake with an even number of cherries, can you always cut it so that the cherries are even? Well, they're all chairs that you bunched up on one side. Show me that. Okay, I don't know what. How do you have chairs bunched up on one side? Okay.
I mean, let's say that our chairs look like this.
Here's six chairs. Is it possible to cut it in half? Principle that doesn't seem to be a problem necessarily. The chairs were all on one side. The hope would be that you could find a way to cut it still.
Oh, and you can split a cherry in half?
Yeah. Well, you cannot split a cherry in half, but the cherries are points. First of all, let's think about what it means. Cherries are points. Okay, points are infinite, these infinitesimally small cherries. Okay?
What if the points fall on the diameter?
Well, it's quite what, does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're not allowed to have cherries get cut in half. Okay?
What if you have all the cherries in a straight line on one half?
I see. Okay, so you would. The trouble that the principle you could have. If you're not allowed to. If you say all the cherries are on a straight line from the center, well, in fact. Okay, again, it depends how you determine it. Obviously, you can say they do have an equal number of cherries on each side. Okay, but by the context of the problems, this would be verboten, right? Not allowed to have any cherries on there. So we sort of agree that if you have too many collinear cherries, okay, there may be a problem. Okay? But what about the case where all the cherries, there's no two cherries, no three cherries that are on the same line? Okay? Or in particular, let's say no two cherries that are on the same line with the center. If so, can we solve this problem? There's always an answer if we are not two cherries that are collinear. You know, I think so. Do you have an argument for that? Well, the problem is that's an argument that they're only giving you answers that are solving it.
That does not necessarily mean that every solution does.
Okay.
If they're not collinear with the center, then definitely.
Okay, why is that?
Because you can just sweep the arm out, and there will be a point where, you know, if you have less cherries over here than over here, then you sweep the arm this way. And at some point, you're going to get the cherry added to this side, and at the same time, not get another cherry added, because then they wouldn't have to be collinear for that half at the same time.
Okay, does everybody see his argument? That actually is a correct argument.
So
okay.
As you're sweeping your own, every time you add a cherry on one side, you're increasing a cherry on the other side.
So that's right.
That's basically the idea. Suppose we have a line that we just make an arbitrary line through the center. It's going to have a certain number of cherries here and a certain number of cherries on that side. Now, if we keep rotating this line through the cherries, if there's no two that are collinear through the origin, then we're going to have each event, each sweep event, is going to knock one cherry, change the cherry count. Okay? And so every cherry is eventually going to get moved over to the other side. Okay? That's basically an argument. But actually, is there any gap that we still have in that argument?
Well, you kind of have to understand it may not happen immediately. Like, you may get, like...
You may gain cherries.
You might gain and lose cherries on the way. But if you go 360 degrees, at some point you will have reached it.
Now, why is that? Because every cherry, if we consider the 360 degree things, every cherry will be added, and every cherry will be lost. Is that correct? So let's think. I mean, that's the basic argument. Although somebody's still not quite see the punchline. Yeah.
Since one's two cherries,
Yeah, every cherry will be its own slice in the circle.
Every cherry is in its own slice in the circle. So right, so if you think of a cherry as being in, there's a you know, a certain angle range which that cherry will be on, let's say, the left side of the, you know, on the right side. And so what if you could do another way to think about the problem, if you think about the angle range from 0 to 360 or something like that, every cherry essentially has a range during which it will be on the left side. And you want an argument to say that somehow that there exists a point where half the cherries are on the left side. Okay? That's somehow what sort of the argument that you want to have. And I'm still not sure, again, I'm reading for Paulie from my feelings here, but I'm still not quite seeing the argument right now that there are half, that there is a place. Why is there? Do we know that there is a place where you're cutting half of that? Well, say now, let's assume the cherry is not on the center.
Okay, that's, I think, part of the, fair part of the specification. Okay? You don't even see why it is happening. Exactly. And I think the idea would be that if you consider the So now the basic idea seems to be that if we speak this thing through, there will be, for every cherry we add, there will be a time when it will be gone. Okay? And every cherry, if we keep sweeping this thing through, it's going to be both added and, you know, eventually added and eventually subtracted.
I don't know if it would be a proof or not, but could you do something like, let's do for argument's sake, we can make multiple cuts on it, so you can keep cutting it so that eventually you're going to have a slice that has one cherry in it. Can you then go backward, you then remove some of those slices, you can then, no matter, if you're able to do that, so that each cherry has its own slice, you then can remove the cuts so that the last cut remaining, each side will have an equal number of cherries.
I don't see how to generalize that cut.
Okay.
So somehow there's still a little bit that I'm not seeing here. Okay. Sort of agree that if we circulate this thing through, one cherry will be moved to one side or the other. And I guess here is sort of the argument, if you want to know the truth. Okay? Let's put it this way. Okay? Let's consider the cherries that are, number of cherries that are on the left of our line as we rotate it through 360 degrees. Okay? We know that we're starting out with a certain number of cherries. Let's say it's more than 50%. Only one side of it has to have more than 50%. Right? And we know, if we go before we start here and sweep to the return, by the time we get back here, every cherry we had will have eventually been deleted. Right? And then, you know, added back again. Okay? So the number of surviving cherries, it really go from something larger than n down to zero, down to, you know, so the number of cherries that are, the set of cherries that we have here, at each cherry we pass, either here we're going to be adding, deleting one, here we're going to be adding one, okay? Now we know that there will be deletions happening at regular intervals. Oh, what?
Okay, well, at any given point, the amount that switches over is only going to be one.
Right.
Okay, so we know it's, you know, we're not going to, say, skip over the answer we want. And we know that if it rotates exactly 180 degrees, it'll be an exact opposite state. If you had more before, you go 180 degrees around, now you have less.
Okay, now that is a compass
idea.
Yeah.
Okay? And
so
we know that it
means an increment
of one.
Exactly right. Okay? So we start out with one. That is the crisp proof that I was looking for. Okay? Everybody sort of see that? We start out now, here we have greater than n over 2 chariots. By the time we rotate the line around 180 degrees, we have to have less than n over 2 chariots. Right? Because everything that was in here is now gone. Does everybody agree with that? Think of it as being a directed, this line that we're rotating as having a direction to it.
You don't have radius or diameter?
No, the diameter.
Diameter, okay.
It's sort of have this complete circular cut thing that's going around. And here we have now, you know, greater than n over 2 chariots without loss of generality, right? By the time we now sweep this line over so that the line is now on this side, on this side, that means it has to be less than n over 2 chariots. Right. Okay. And since it's changing one by one, we know that if walking, if you're walking from here to there, sort of like it's like a mean values theorem argument or something like a continuity argument. You're starting out at n over greater than it is n over 2. Here's something greater than n over 2. Here's something less than n over 2. You're starting out here and walking to here, sometime you have to cross the axis. And at that point, you've got n over 2 chariots on each side.
Okay, I get it.
Everybody get that now? This is a pretty argument. If you don't get it, it's probably worth talking about. Yeah. Okay, well, let's look at what's happening. Let's look at an example here. Suppose, let's say, we have five cherries, and here I've got one cherry. Okay? Notice that the line here cuts five cherries on this side. If I rotate this line around, now I consider the line that is basically from here on over, it's only going to have one cherry on this side. Well, no. Think about what's happening as we add it. So we're going to sweep this line, we rotate it at an angle. When we just get past here, what's going to have happened? At this point, we lost a cherry, right? Does everybody agree with that? This is now a cut of four. And when we get to here, rotating it around, that's going to be a cut. We've lost another one. This is a cut of three. So this is, in fact, what we want, right? Rotating it here, in fact, what are we doing? Are we gaining or losing a cherry?
Is that actually? Yeah, we gained one.
Right.
So we have now gained a cherry. So we're back up to four. Here, we're going to lose one, we're down to three. Here, we're going to lose one, we're down to two. Here, we're going to lose one, we're down to one. Right? And then we're back to 180 degrees. The important sign is that if we started at something greater than n over 2, ended up at something less than n over 2, and we're changing one thing at a time. Let's put it this way. We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 people in the room. Okay? Suppose you guys get bored enough with the lecture that all of you leave. Okay? We'll only fix one person at a time. Will there at some point be one person in the room with me? The answer, there has to be, right? Because it's a countdown from 8
to zero, you have to pass to one. Okay? And that's basically the argument here.
Now, this would have broke down if we had two cherries that were collinear to the
this
center.
This will break down in the case of two cherries that are collinear to the center.
Okay?
And this is actually one reason why geometry problems are somewhat, going to be somewhat difficult when we program them, are what I would call special cases. Okay? There's no sort of degeneracy in geometry. Of special cases where everything's sort of working. And they have this beautiful theorem that says that you can always cut these cherries, provided they're not too on a line. Okay? And that's the kind of thing that happens, you know, reasonably often. So in your programming, you have to be aware of the special cases. One of the big geometry problems in this one, and difficult to program. Yes?
Yeah, I think it doesn't mention anything about the cherries not being collinear. It just mentions that there is a solution to the problem.
Okay. So anyway, think about how you can do that. I think that that's, this now should start to seem tractable. The other weirdness here about this problem is that they're giving you cherries, they're telling you that your lines have to pass through the center, but they also tell you that the coordinates of your things have to be, your equation of your line has to be defined by integers instead of floating point, which might cause some weirdnesses. We'll talk a little bit about that later, but that's the other potential weirdness here. Any questions? Okay. The final problem is, I think, the one that's the most interesting. Interesting meaning it's not clear to me to what it, exactly how you solve it. But I think it's, it's something we have to think about. Okay? Problem is here, we've got a bunch of circles. Okay? And we would like to put the circles in a box. Let's say these are... why would someone want to pack circles? What oranges? Well, it could be oranges. Could be. Let's say we were a.
CDs.
Well, CDs are all the same size. Let's say that you were carrying. This could be a little topic. Let's say you were trying to carry away missiles. Let's say you're a recently deposed dictator of a country. Okay, you're trying to hide. Carry out evidence of your weapons program with you. Okay? And, you know, these missiles, you lay them on the side, they're all different thicknesses. Okay? Missiles come in big things and little things. Okay? And you'd like a box to pack your missiles. Where, you know, missiles, because they're very volatile, you know, they explode. You have to be careful. You have to pack them laying on the side in a box. Okay? And, so the goal is that we'd like to pack our missiles in as tight a box as we can, where every missile lies on the bottom of the box, okay? And, you know, we use the smallest, we minimize the length across, okay? Any questions about that? If your missiles come in the same size, there's only one size missile, is this a hard problem or not? It's a trivial problem. What would be the answer? Some of the diameters, right? Does everybody agree with that? That if the missiles were all the same size, the best you could do to pack them would be to lay them next to each other. Okay, and that's some of the diameter. But suppose you now have a very small missile, maybe you could crack it in there. Okay? Or, you know, it would cost you way more. Okay? Or maybe you get a slightly bigger missile because you're trying to move these guys aside. And something like that. So this is what I think is interesting, and we can talk about that later, but this is, I think, the interesting or potentially challenging one algorithmically. The other three, I think, algorithmically are now pretty well understood, okay? And now really the question is, how do you program them? Any questions about these problems? Okay? Let's go and do some geometry. I'll talk a little bit about how you program things in geometry. Because some of you have probably done some programming related to geometry. Has anyone taken the graphics course? Yeah. What are you thinking now? Do you do some programming related to geometry? You worry about lines and things like that in the graphics class? A little bit, okay. Have you had any issues with anything interesting come up when you were programming?
geometrically.
When you were in a, you know, in the algorithm, in a graphics class.
A little bit of trigonometry. Okay, so we'll do a little bit of trigonometry. But, okay, so let's think about geometry. Okay, and the problems we're going to talk about here are associated with problems related to lines, points, circles. Okay? I think all of them, that's all that we really need for any of these, somehow lines, points, and circles in the plane. Now, what's interesting is, well, it's something, even though geometry is somehow very simple, you took it in high school, you've probably forgotten it, but I think that if you read the chapter, you'll remember, oh yes, that's what a tangent is, that's what a slope is, okay? So that's obviously a hard thing. The thing that makes, I think, these problems a little bit challenging is that programming geometric things requires us to work with somewhat messier objects than we have dealt with before. One thing it requires is floating point numbers. Okay, a lot of these problems require, you know, the slope of something is a ratio. You know, what is a line? A line is, you know, we'll talk more about that, but you know, basically, you should remember a line is an equation of something like y equals mx plus b, where m is the slope and b is the intercept. In general, these m and b can be floating point numbers. Right?
Sounds like in line 1/2 x plus 0.395b. Okay?
So first of all, now we're going to have to, in principle, deal with floating point. And so there's problems with the numerical uncertainty and precision. But more fundamental, there are certain operations in geometry that seem obvious to people, okay, that conceptually, that are somewhat hard to program, and especially to program robustly. For example, how would you compute the intersection of two lines? Well, they give you two points, two lines. We know that two straight lines intersect at one point, except for a couple of special cases. What are the special cases?
They're
parallel, then they don't intersect at all. If they are the same line, they intersect in every place, right? So one problem we have to deal with is something called, what I will call degeneracies. Okay, I consider special cases to be things I consider degeneracies. You know, what happens if the lines they give you are parallel? Okay, what do you report as an intersection? What if they are the same, what if they are the same lines? Okay, those are special cases that have to be dealt with in some way. And one problem with geometric programming is the special cases tend to multiply. If you're not careful, you don't deal with it in a clear way. Okay, so I want to show you my primitives that I've implemented for some of these. Just sort of show you how you can make some of them go away. What special cases? Well, how would you compute? Let's just try this as maybe a little exercise here. How would you compute the intersection of two lines, the point of intersection of two lines?
It's basically solving for two equations, I mean two variables, right?
So you're solving for two variables, okay? So what is it you're saying? You're saying here you have y equals mx plus b, 1, 1. Y equals m1 and 2x plus b2. What is the point of intersection for that?
Where x and y are the same.
Where x and y are the same. So how would you solve for that to be equal?
Yeah.
What? So while the one in terms of the other, well, what does that mean? Let's just double check that. So you want to say the y's are the same. So you're saying m1x plus b1 equals m2x plus b2. Okay, now we solve for x, what does that mean? That means something like b2 minus b1 over something like m, what do we have here? M1 minus m2 is equal to x. Is that right, basically? And now you take this thing and you now plug this thing into x to get you the y. Now, under what condition won't this work?
If the lines are parallel.
The lines are parallel, this won't work. Why is that? Well, there is no point of it, but what's going to happen when you try?
Oh, you're going to give zero for the slope, for the denominator?
Yes, zero is your denominator, and now you get a core dump, or whatever, I don't know, Java, you may get something else, okay, but it's an exception, okay? Does everybody agree that, that's an example of where the degeneracies come in? Blindly applying the formula doesn't work. The other question is, does this work for all possible lines?
No,
well, my whole straight line. I'm only dealing with straight lines here. But is there any problem with this? Do we have any other special issue that we have to deal with? Vertical line. What's wrong with a vertical line? Vertical means what? Like this? What's wrong with that vertical line? Slope is zero. Is that the slope of zero?
The slope is undefined, really.
Yeah.
Slope is undefined. What is the equation of this line?
I can't define it. Y equals M x plus B.
It's x equals...
X equals C.
Yeah.
Does actually everybody agree that that's what a vertical line is? So now you see we're representing this thing. If you want your program to work for all lines, you have trouble if you're going to be working with Y equals MX plus B. Because Y equals MX plus B doesn't have any, let's just think about it. Is that true to this case? For X equals, Y equals MX plus B, you can't represent X equals C. You know, just given these two slots. Okay? So to build something that is a general and robust way of dealing with lines, you want a line representation that is general enough to include the vertical lines in a way that's relatively seamless. Yes?
Can you, like, in the beginning, just check those two special cases?
Oh, sure, you can check for these two special cases, but first of all, what are they going to do? This now means that if you're going to check for it everywhere, now got the problem that you may be having special logic. So what do you do with degenerate cases? This is sort of a big problem when you're programming with geometry. One possibility is you insert a special clue at every point to say, well, if the thing is vertical, then do it this way. The trouble is, the more cases you have, the more code you have. But more than that, the possibility of having a subtle error at one point since you broke dramatically. Okay? Does everybody see that even representing a line is not as straightforward as we might think of? What would be a way that we could represent a line that, let's say, would a generic way to represent a line that might avoid these problems? Let's think about it. Yeah?
Simple way might be there.
So one, let's say, more robust way to represent a line would be just to give two points that are on the line. Okay, does everybody agree that if you have two distinct points, every line is defined by two distinct points? Okay? And maybe that would give you one way that is general. You could deal with vertical, you could deal with horizontal. Okay, you deal with every line like that. Okay? Although it may or may not make your computations actually easier when you need them. But in principle, that potentially solves our problem. Okay, well, I don't yet see how to work with it. Okay? Any questions?
So, the way that I was doing it was a little bit different. Okay? Which is to define a, what you call it. We agreed that basically, to summarize basically our discussion, we agreed that the straight line is the shortest distance between two points. So we're going to be talking about lines here. Not line segments. Line segments have a starting point and an ending point. We'll deal with line segments when we get to computational geometry next week. We could describe a line as a pair of points. We could describe a line as y equals mx plus b in the plane, except for the fact that we have vertical lines. Okay? So what is my solution? My solution is to represent each line by three coordinates. Okay? I'm going to represent a line using the more general formula, y equals ax plus by plus c equals 0.
Okay? And this, I claim, can represent every single line. Why is that? Can you give me a proof that this represents, that we can represent every single line using these three coordinates? A stands for A, B stands for B. These are constants, okay? So X and Y are the functional variables. But I think what a Y is, X and Y are the variables associated with a line. But every point is described by an X and a Y coordinate. A line is a set of four X, Y points, right? And there is, because it's a line, a linear relationship between them. So once you fix X, that uniquely fixes Y, right? So what are the coordinates? So A, B, and C are, I'm using here instead of M and B.
A and B represent kind of the ratio of difference. It's analogous to the slope, in a sense, but you don't have any division problems because you can set A or B.
Right, so what can I do? Basically, I guess basically what you're saying here is right. I can sort of say that I am, if I want to represent the line y equals mx plus b, well, by setting b equal to 0 to 1, and a equal m, and c equal to the minus intercept, that actually would represent all the lines that I had before. If I set A equal to 1 and B equal to 0, I can represent that special case of the vertical line. Everybody agree with that? So I think that with these three constants, describing a line as being the X coefficient, Y coefficient, and a constant R, I can represent any line. What problem is there with this representation? Is there something that's, let's say, not so good about some drawback of this kind of a representation that you might see? Yeah?
One potential drawback is it's not intuitively obvious how this translates, you know, to me. I can't look at that equation and go, oh, I make sense of that and draw that line instantaneously just because I'm not as familiar with it.
Okay.
So in that sense, it's kind of a minor
point. In that case, that's a minor point. But anything else, yes?
It's not unique.
It's not unique. Okay? Does everybody see that a line can now have more than one representation? Why is that? Well, suppose I represent the normal equation. Let's say y equals, let's say I have a normal, once I have a normal representation here, if I multiply each one of these terms by a constant, for example, if I multiply each one of these by 1, by 2, 2, and 2, this side, 2 times 0 is 0. That will describe exactly the same line. So it's no longer a unique representation, which would make it harder to, for example, tell whether two lines are identical. Correct? Does everybody see that? Yeah.
So why don't you just make A instead of A being a constant? Why don't you just make A 1?
Why don't I make A 1? So one possibility is I always set A equal to 1.
But that won't guarantee. I'm just only these new doubles.
But that. Setting A equal to 1 won't always work.
No,
because
always
what about the line, what do you call it?
Yeah, because you could have, you want y equals 0.
What about the line, right, what about the line y equals 3? Okay, so I can't make it canonical by always setting this 1. Okay. How can I make this canonical? Canonical meaning there's only one way, one unique representation for a line. Okay? I have to assign some kind of a standard.
The way that I did it was the following. I said that basically the y coefficient, I'm going to insist that the y coefficient is 1 if it is non-zero. Okay? And otherwise I said the x coefficient is 1. Okay? This is how I chose to make it canonical. Okay? And I claim that that gives you a unique representation. Okay?
So if y is 0, we set x coefficient to 1.
If y is 0...
I'm sorry, I said that wrong. Excuse me, if b is 0, that means a is 1, right?
So this sort of makes sense. If y is equal to 1, this is sort of like the special case y equals mx plus b. Okay? If I'm going to have a y, the coefficient is 1. Okay? And then otherwise, if it is 0, I'm always going to set the x coordinate to 1 to avoid the problem with duplicates. Okay? Any questions? So now I have a fairly robust representation. Okay, I get the advantage that I can represent any line, and I can do it in a canonical way. So I can compare if two lines are the same. Any questions? Okay? So,
and this is sort of what I have wrote, just to sort of warm us up a little bit. Here are little routines for, converting between the representation where I represent the line as a pair of points. Okay, how did I do that?
Well, if the x coordinate of one was equal to the x coordinate of another, what does that mean? It's a vertical line, and that was the troublesome case. So there I said the coordinate of the x was 1, the coordinate of the y was 0, and then I set the intercept to be basically what the x value was. Otherwise, as I said, the y coefficient equal to 1, and then basically just did it the way that we had here. The a coefficient is the slope, and then the b coefficient, like we solved it over here, was basically the intercept. Any questions?
A point is a struct, I assume?
A point that I have, I just didn't write it here. Actually, what I have here is a little bit different. I don't think you can see. The way I actually did it was somewhat cute here. I actually have a point being represented by an array of two elements. Okay? And I defined a global, enumerated type x that was equal to 0 and y equal to the other one. Now, what was an advantage of that? What kind of things might I have as an advantage? Well, one thing, if I wanted, let's say that this is an example of why this, so I'm bringing each point, let's say, as a two-dimensional array. Why might that, under some circumstance, be better than representing it as two fields? Yeah. It would be easier to go to a higher number of dimensions if I wanted to, although probably other things will break when I suddenly say I wanted to have this thing work in three dimensions. But the other thing, this is an example, sometimes it gives you more flexibility. So one thing, for example, you could do. Suppose, let's say, I wanted to find out what was the largest single coordinate. Let's say I have an array of points. Let's say I want to find the largest single coordinate of anything. The magnitude being the largest. Well, it could be 4i goes from 1 to n, find the largest of the x's, or I goes 1 to n, find the largest of the y's, and take the larger of the two of them. That would be what you would do if these were struct things. But you could now do it with two nested loops, using my representation. 4j goes from x to y, 4i goes from 1 to n. Is this the largest thing I've seen before? So there's some extra flexibility you get here. Okay, it's not necessarily the best way to do it in general, but that's how I chose it. Okay, any questions? Okay, so I would probably want to defend that if I was building a large system. Okay, in principle, the struct may be a clearer thing to do, but it's somewhat debatable. Here, I think I had certain advantages by doing it. Any questions? Okay? And then likewise, I could also go the other way. I could also convert a point and slope representation. Well, I did it as a little routine where if I have a point and slope representation, that's going to handle everything except vertical lines. And in fact, these coefficient values are easily determined. Okay? And that's what that second routine does.
Any questions? Okay? So that's how I would represent lines. Now, how would you compute the intersection of lines in this representation? Okay, we talked a little bit about that. But how would we compute the intersection point of two lines in our representation? First, I define a primitive to tell whether or not they were the two lines were parallel. Under what conditions were they parallel? Okay. Normally, two lines are parallel if the slopes were the same. Here, there's a special case where there's sort of the coefficient of the x and the coefficient of the y. So basically, so long as the coefficients of the x and the y terms are the same, then the lines will be parallel in my canonical representation. Well, certainly we'll agree. Let's convince ourselves of it. I mean, in the general case, basically because of the way I make my lines canonical, in the general case, suppose I have lines 1, 1, 2. Under the normal representation, you know these two lines would be parallel if these slopes were the same. In my representation, how would I have represented ax plus by plus c equals 0? Well, I would have set b equal to 1. A is going to be equal to m, or minus m, I think. A is minus m. And so really, these two lines would be in parallel if this coordinate and this coordinate are the same. Coefficient is the same. And it would also be, notice this also handles a special case of two vertical lines. Because in the case of two vertical lines, what's it going to be? It's going to be a1x plus by, where y is 0, plus c is a2x plus 0y plus c. Two lines will be parallel if and only if these coefficients, this coefficient is same as that, this coefficient is same as that. Any questions?
I'm sorry, what is FABS in the code, and what is epsilon?
Okay, so now why then do I make it a little uglier? Well, first of all, what is FABS? That is for the floating point absolute value.
Uh-huh.
And why do I say less than epsilon? Okay, yeah?
Because absolute value, where you're dealing with floating points, and so you have some amount of inaccuracy.
There's some weirdnesses with floating point computation. Okay? Now, have people experienced weirdnesses in floating point computation before? How many people have? I'm just curious. In the course of your day-to-day life, in the course of your previous programming life, have you ever built a program and found that floating point zero was not equal to zero, and therefore you had a problem? You've had this problem.
Yeah, I had this mostly
when I was, you know, when programs were set up to look for it more than anything else. But, you know, it doesn't happen. It doesn't seem to happen.
Okay. So anyway, so this was sort of an attempt to program somewhat defensively. I set up an error epsilon. Okay. And if you look at my programs, I do try to issue warnings when I get too close to things. Okay. Well, now this is sort of a weird thing. Okay, so for me to get, I define epsilon to be a small number. Okay. Now, how small? You know. So you're right. Okay. This is still not a perfect solution. Okay. Trying to come up with a perfectly robust program in floating point, geometric program in floating point, is an extremely difficult but probably impossible thing. So, in the research geometric algorithms community, if you really want robustness, they'll insist on your points being integers. Okay? One of the problems in here is it demanded that your coefficients be integers, for example. And that's one reason why, you know. But in general, it's useful to have floating points, and so this is how I got around that. Okay?
Now, you know, if you think very hard and you do things very carefully, there might be other ways of getting around it. But this is how I chose to do it.
What state library is it? It's FA Maps Found.
Okay. I believe that is probably found in the math library. So, that's linked in the math library. Okay. And so how did I compute the parallel, the intersection point? Well, we did the algebra here to compute what the x and y coordinates are. And again, we saw that there was a trouble if the slopes were the same. So basically, what were my special cases? If the two lines were the same, I printed out a warning, because that meant that the all points were identical. And I just failed out and gave something. Okay, because likely that's not what you wanted. But this is useful in debugging to print out these things rather than to just crash. Okay? The other situation, I said, if the two lines were parallel, then I pointed out that there was no intersection point. Okay, and then we would, you know, just do something. Okay? But the general case, again, was that I computed what was the x-coordinate, which is now trivial, once, you know, what you call it. Let's just think about it. So but where is the trouble going to be for a vertical line? So if one of the lines is vertical, okay, somehow I had a special case here. Okay? Do we want to figure out what that actually is? Well, if let's think what this is. F of L1B is greater than epsilon. Okay? I guess the vertical case is probably here. Okay, so wait. The B coordinate was what? It was AX plus B was the Y thing. By checking greater than epsilon, that was how I was distinguishing my two cases here of 0 and 1. And if you want, we can go through it, but I claim that there is a different special case here for the vertical line. Any questions? You want me to go through that, or just people sort of believe it and believe they can work that out? Okay? Fine. But this is the kind of defensive programming you need to worry about in order to compute this. Now you've got to make sure you handle that case. Any questions? And this suggests also one other thing. Because these kind of special cases are ugly, it's much better if you can limit them to a few routines, like intersection points, and then use that routine over and over again, rather than dealing with special cases in lots of other places. Okay? So it's important here to write the right primitives and make sure that they're general. Any questions? Okay. What other geometric thing do we want to know? We might want to know how to compute angles. Okay? And what's interesting about angles? Well, again, you know what an angle is. So you have to take geometry. Whenever you have two lines going through a point, there are two angles defined. Theta. The opposite. So now, two lines define four quadrants. The two opposite angles are going to be equal. Right? Does that ring a bell? So this would be theta. What is this angle here going to be? Well, it's 180 minus theta, provided you're talking about degrees. Okay? If you're not talking about degrees, what is it? Pi minus theta. Okay? So one other thing that you're going to have to worry about when you're doing trigonometry is you're going to want to use your system's trigonometry libraries, okay? And your favorite C, C++, and Java all have, you know, the standard trigonometric functions. But most of them are going to assume things are measured in radians. I usually think of it in terms of angle degrees also. But realize your program had better think in terms of radians. Yes?
This is maybe kind of irrelevant. Why in the heck do we still learn to use degrees?
Why do you learn to use degrees in a world where everybody else learns how to use radians?
It seems like everybody I know has learned degrees first. And it's not really, it doesn't seem like there's anything good about it, because it seems like so much works out more elegantly with radians that everybody has.
Okay, well, one thing is that I think, so that's an interesting question. First of all, does anybody know where 360 comes from?
I believe that's from the ancient Babylonians, were the ones who, they made it base 60
or something like that. But somehow I know that 360 is a legacy of them. You probably need to know about that there are 360 degrees in the surface. This is a figure of speech.
I mean, some, you know, somebody says, you know, I'm going to, you know, turn around 180 degrees or something like that. You can talk about, you know, that's a, something you learn about in normal speech. Okay? So that's maybe why it is. But now, scientific people seem to deal with radians. One other question, did anybody ever deal with minutes?
Rarely.
The real way, quote unquote, the old fashioned way to describe an angle. Well, for example, a good example of where degrees come in, I guess, is when we talk about longitude and latitude.
Okay.
It's an important example of things that are measured in terms of degrees. Right? So, degrees, you know, still seem to be used in a lot of places. Okay? But one thing that is bad is, that a classic way to describe longitude and latitude, if you look and say, what is the latitude of New York City? It will usually be something like 45 degrees, you know, 63 minutes, or something like that. Okay? And what is a degree? Well, a degree, we agree, is 1/360th of a circle. What is a minute? 1/60th of a degree. So if you have angles of degrees and minutes, it's incredibly difficult to deal with, right? Usually when you've dealt with degrees, you've probably had 45.32 degrees.
Yeah.
But notice that decimal degrees is sort of a, not the traditional concept. Okay, so that may be one reason why radians is a good thing, because we've gotten all this stuff washed away. Okay? Yeah.
Sorry, silly question. When you use that formula to find the tangents, they're right.
Okay? So what is the situation we say here? Well, okay, so what do I say here? We now know about degrees. We have to worry about whether we know about radians or degrees. That's one little detail. We agree that two lines that intersect, they're going to define an angle between them. What is that angle between them? You've got a line, you've got 2 points. What is the angle? How would you find the angle between two lines? Okay. Anybody have any ideas of that? We'll use this formula. Let's just see where that actually is. So one thing this does is gives you the tangents of the angle. How would you go between the tangent and figure out the actual angle from that? So you would call the arctangent function here. So your trigonometric library should have an arctangent function to let you move between tangents and angles and vice versa. Okay?
Give it to us in radians, I assume.
Well, it depends upon what your library does. Read the instructions before you use them. Okay? But okay, fine. Now, when two lines intersect at a right angle, suppose I give you a line L equals mx plus b. What line intersects it at a right angle, meaning that this is 90 degrees or pi over 2 radians?
The intersecting line B can be anything, and M. M2 would be equal to negative 1 over M1.
Negative 1 over M1. Does everybody remember that? That the slope of this was M, the slope of this thing, is it negative M over 2, or is it negative?
Negative reciprocal.
The negative reciprocal, or is it the reciprocal?
Negative reciprocal.
Negative reciprocal.
Okay,
let's see what I did next. That's a good question.
Okay. So we agree that somehow that gives you a way to, that is what I said. Right, okay, good. So we agree. Okay? So we now have a way to compute perpendicular lines, if necessary. Any questions? Okay. There's one other primitive that is often very, very useful in these geometric problems.
Suppose, let's say, I give you a
point, and I give you a line, what is the closest, how do we compute the closest point on the line to that other point? I have a point P.
No, make it a little more general.
Here's my line L. Suppose I want to compute the point on the line that is closest to my target point. How would I compute it?
Keeping that line where you drew a line, it would be a right angle. You drew a line with the union.
So the closest distance is going to be defined with the line that goes through that point and intersects L at a right angle. Does everybody sort of agree with that? If I tilt this line a little bit further away, that distance is only going to get longer, right? So we know that that's the line that it's on. What is the distance? What is the actual coordinates of this point, though? How would it figure that out?
Well, if you know the equation for L, you can figure out the equation for that perpendicular line because we know how to solve for that. It's the slope is the negative reciprocal.
Right.
And then you just have to set those two equations equal and figure out where they intersect.
So basically, by taking the negative reciprocal of the slope of this thing, we get the slope of this other line. We have to find the intercept of that line that goes through our target point D. Okay, so what do we give it? We give it as input P, input L. We want to find the closest point on L to P. How do we find that? Well, we can construct the perpendicular line through P. The slope of the perpendicular line will be determined by the slope of L. Okay, modulo the special cases of horizontal and vertical. Then once we have the slope of this, how do we figure out what the intercept is?
We plug it into the equation.
We
have y equals mx plus
b. Y equals mx plus b.
We just plug in x.
We have n. For p, we have this point. We have this, we have this, and each one unknown. And so we can solve that to get this line. Once we have that line, we already described how to find the intersection of two lines, correct? The point at the intersection of two lines. So I claim we can compute this point relatively easily. In fact, I claim this is the subroutine to do it. Okay? Let's think about it. If I give you a line and a point, okay, what is the special case? Okay? I'm going to compute the, let me think about what I'm going to do. In the special case of the horizontal and vertical, I'm going to deal with them separately. Okay? That's basically what I did here. But in general, what am I saying? I have my routine is a given a point and the slope of the line. Find the line. Okay? I showed you that routine before. Then return the intersection point. Okay? Any questions? Okay? And again, we manage to XI, get rid of the special cases relatively simply and cleanly. Any questions?
Okay. I think, let me see if there's anything else that I have. Yeah, I have more geometry type stuff from the chapter, but I think that, class is winding down a little bit. Okay, so maybe this is where I'm going to break. Okay, but let's just take another look at the problems quickly, just to make sure we see if we have the tools we need. Dog and gopher, do we have a way to figure out, the distance? Between how to figure out the distance from the dog and the gopher to a hole. That's I think the Euclidean distance formula. We didn't talk about that, but I think you should be able to figure that one out pretty easily. For the rope land thing,
you want to be able to determine the somehow we haven't talked about circles, but we need to figure out which line is tangent to a circle.
okay, as part of our argument, and figure out what the angles are in there, okay? This stuff is in the text, and I'll talk about it next class if it's interesting.
The birthday cake one. Okay, so now you need to figure out, vary the slope of the line as you rotate it around and count how many things are on each side. So how being able to deal with the lines is useful. And how big is it is probably the hardest of the bunch. Okay? So hopefully everyone will get at least the first one. And maybe, I think this is probably the easiest. This is probably next easiest. And all these, in terms of what we know already. Okay, although these two might be the absolute easiest of the bunch. The distance between points is?
Oh, that, you mentioned something that you hadn't gone over for dogs.
We didn't talk about the Euclidean distance function. But that's something that everybody should know from life. What is the distance between points?
X1,
oh,
X2,
okay.
Y1, and X2, Y2. Well, the distance is just delta X plus delta Y. Square root.
That's right. Okay, I'm sorry.
Okay. Any questions? Okay, good. Good luck. Think about it, and hopefully we can get some geometry this week.
Okay, thanks a lot.